And number three, there will be a question and answer period after the speaker has finished her presentation. Please hold your questions until then. Speaker at this time is Barbara Allen Babcock. She is currently the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Before that, she was an Associate Professor, Stanford Law School, the Director of Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia, worked in the staff of the Attorney of the Legal Aid Agency for the District of Columbia, and in the law firm of Edward Benet Williams. She was also a law clerk to Judge Henry Edgerton from the United States Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. A native of Washington, she earned her bachelor's degree from the University of Pennsylvania, where she was a Phi Beta Kappa, valedictorian, College for Women president, debate counsel Woodrow Wilson scholar, and while earning her law degree at Yale Law School, Ms. Babcock was involved in the Order of the Coin, the Yale Law Journal, and won the Harlan Fiske Stone Prize. I am sure you're looking forward to hearing about Ms. Babcock and her present position in the Justice Department. Welcome.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. This is the first time I've ever been designated as distinguished, and that's very exciting in and of itself. I thought what I would talk about a little bit informally is how I became Assistant Attorney General, and talk to you a little bit about what I do and how being a woman affects that, and I hope affects it positively. And then I would like very much to engage you all in a discussion. I don't think the Justice Department is very well understood by some of us who are within it, in fact. But I would be glad to hear and to discuss with you what you're particularly interested in. I think that the way I got to be a distinguished woman speaker is because the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division is a presidential appointee. When I returned to Washington from teaching at Stanford to take this job, when I was around at parties and receptions, the spoken and sometimes unspoken question was, how did you get this job? Did you know Griffin Bell, the Attorney General? Did you work for Carter? Or maybe you knew Rosalynn? The answer to all those questions is no, that I didn't know Griffin Bell, and I didn't work for Carter. And the real way that I am a Democrat, which I think it would have been probably disqualifying had I not been, I'm not proud of the fact that I've never been active in politics, but it's just that I have been busy with other things, so I never have been a political person. The way I got this job is really a direct result of the women's movement, and I feel very grateful for that, because we arrived at a point, and I think particularly with the difficulties that the Attorney General had in his confirmation hearing, where he had to, he was under pressure to appoint women to significant posts in the Justice Department. And these jobs as Assistant Attorney General are wonderful jobs. I mean, they pay a lot of money. They carry a tremendous amount of responsibility and prestige within the legal community, and yet they are not jobs that have been open to women. And there was only one woman previously in the history of the world or the Justice Department who ever had such a job. And they have been very much jobs that were given to the male legal establishment. And so that it is only as little as 5 years ago, no woman could have had this job. And yet, once it became determined that a woman would be appointed, or women would be appointed to high-ranking jobs in the Justice Department, then women like myself, who have the credentials, but would never have been looked at, had a shot at it. And so that in a way it's been extremely gratifying. And I consider myself a feminist. I have both taught in the field of sex discrimination and written a book on sex discrimination in the law, which is used as a law school textbook and is used in colleges in some places. And I was also gratified that being a feminist and being an ardent feminist and a person who has spent a good deal of her legal career on feminist causes was not in any way disqualifying. I thought that was another move in the right direction, that the fact that I was really identified with the women's movement was not counted against me. And I think that many of you who have been involved in these things know that sometimes that's not the way it is, especially if what you're after is an establishment kind of job. So many, I think, of the women that we see getting the very prestigious, particularly in the legal profession, very prestigious establishment jobs, are not feminist or have never thought about it one way or the other. Maybe they're not necessarily anti-feminist. So that I am really delighted to be at the Justice Department and in the Civil Division and in a job which I never would have in my wildest dreams or expectations thought could have happened. The Civil Division is the oldest division in the Justice Department, and it is, we defend the government in whenever it is sued, and it is very much the style to sue the government these days, so that the government is sued, and I made a list the other day of the number of our clients, our client agencies. We have about 260 client agencies, and every time a bank fails, the government is sued because allegedly it didn't regulate or didn't watch closely enough. Every time a mine collapses or a plane crashes, the government is sued. The government is sued every day for enforcing its regulations or failing to enforce them or not enforcing the right ones. The range, every time an accident happens on a ship, the government is sued. Water is polluted, the government is sued. It goes on and on, so that we have this tremendous range of cases. As I found, the Civil Division, which has, it is a very large law firm. We have 270 lawyers and 600 employees. All together, including support personnel. I found it to be literally reflective and very much like the rest of the Justice Department, which is pale and male, and in fact is a white male bastion traditionally. Among our 270 lawyers, when I came, we had 9 minorities. Count them, 9. And 18% women, which is rather stunning, particularly the women figure is very stunning, but the minority figure is even more stunning because there are really a great number of minority lawyers available in Washington, D.C. That is something that I thought at once that I could do something about, and I want to tell you a little bit how we've gone about it, but to present to you first the progress that we've made in the hiring that we have done in the Civil Division in the last 8 months. We have hired 63% women and 20% minorities, and that's out of about 45 new positions. That has, and I intend that profile will continue to change. Yes.
Could you repeat those figures
again? In the last 8 months, almost 9. I want to tell you how I'm confident this profile will continue to change. And develop, and I'm also very confident that this has been done without any harm to quality whatsoever. I think that one, I haven't had to do any substantial amount of recruiting, surprisingly, in order to get these results. And the reason for that, and it's just as simple as this fact, which is that I'm there, that there is a woman at the top who has expressed an interest in improving the hiring picture at Justice. And so that we are getting about 20 resumes a day from people who are interested in coming to work in the civil division, and many, many of those are highly qualified minorities and women. And so that, to me, it has been a dramatic exhibition of the effect that appointing women to these kinds of jobs can have, of the ripple effect of it. And it's been, it was an almost immediate thing. The other thing that we have done, and that I have spent almost as much time on as being head of the civil division, is to establish an employment review committee. And this was done with the approval of the Attorney General by the Associate Attorney General for all hiring within the Justice Department, all hiring of attorneys. We're starting with attorneys, though our problems don't end with attorneys. But the attorneys are, in a way, the most visible representatives of the people and of the Justice Department, because they're out in the courts across the country. Drew Days, who's the head of the civil division, who is a civil rights division, who's a black man, and I were made the co-chairpersons of an employment review committee. And I want to talk to you a little bit about it, because it's been kind of an incredible experience to me in two ways. One is that I was amazed to learn that in this kind of organization, as big as the Justice Department is, and as important as it is that it represent all the people, that there was no way to look at hiring in a centralized fashion. And so that just as a very simple management tool to set up a committee to review all hiring from all our offices, boards, and divisions, and from the Assistant U.S. Attorney's offices, would seem to be something that shouldn't get anybody upset, that you just would always, we were set up to look at all the hiring that was done and to keep records of all the hiring that was done. What resulted when the committee was set up were front page stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times and some AP stories across the country about how morale was being destroyed at Justice, and that the top white lawyers felt that men had no future at all there and were seeking other positions. I mean, that happened just from a simple memorandum setting up a committee that says they're going to look at all hiring. Then I received a veritable storm of letters from, particularly from U.S. attorneys, but from the offices, boards, and divisions, asking about procedures and rules that we certainly have never established and will never establish. For instance, there were a number of inquiries about the rule that no white men could be hired for 1 year. Nobody realizes, in a sense, how insulting this is, that we would be so foolish to either make such a rule or certainly to put it down on paper. I also received a lot of inquiries about another rule that exists, which was the pairing rule. And that was, and this was really widely believed, the pairing rule is that for every white male you hire, you must hire either a minority or a woman. And there were questions about how long the pairing rule was going to be in effect. And of course, there is no rule like that at all either. But the fact, and I really do believe that the Employment Review Committee is a very interesting tool for affirmative action, because we have yet, in the 5 months that we've been in existence, we have yet to reject any proposed hire. And there have been, of course, a number of qualified white males, and their future continues to be very bright at the Justice Department, which I think that they're coming to believe. We haven't rejected anybody, and yet there has been, just by the fact that somebody is watching and that you have to fill out a form. We require for new hires and for promotions a form for the Employment Review Committee which says, where did you get this person? Who else was considered? And why was this person chosen over the others? And sometimes when we see that a white male is being hired and but there were minorities or women interviewed, we say, why? What were the qualifications of the people that you failed to hire or failed to promote? And we just look into it, and we usually there are very good reasons. But from the time of our existence, there has really been a dramatic increase, not across the board, but in most of the divisions of justice and in the Assistant United States Attorney's offices, in the number of minorities and the number of women that have been hired. And we have kind of developed for ourselves a helping function also, in that many of these people have just never thought about outreach. And we have been able to convince them that what we are concerned with is the process by which they choose their people. And and we are concerned that they create a pool from which they draw the most qualified applicants, but that there be established a feeling of access to what are really extraordinarily good jobs for lawyers. And yet the jobs have not in the past, and it must be recognized, been equally available to women and minorities. And so and there's been more acceptance in the past weeks of this than in the earlier weeks of the notion that what we're concerned about is reaching out and creating true access to the jobs. It's not that you have to have a quota certainly not a quota or even a goal. It just is that you should reach out and look for the qualified people and create a spirit in which there is an understanding that these very valuable and secure and important kind of jobs are available across the line. So I am very confident, although the Employment Review Committee takes a tremendous amount of time because with an organization the size of the Justice Department, there is constant hiring and promotion activity going on, and yet it's been one of the most satisfying things that I've done in the last 8 months, and I am very confident that we can reach a point where the lawyers in the Justice Department not only represent the government, but are also our representative of the people in the United States and the kind of people that we have. Now, I just wanted to say one other word before I just open it up to discussion. The second kind of area in which I think that being a woman in this kind of job with this kind of responsibility and with my particular concerns, it is helpful is that I can have some impact from the top on the way the government approaches and litigates cases. I have, for instance, the cases of sex discrimination against government agencies, which are legion, are defended by the Civil Division. One of the concerns that became apparent to me early on is the fact that there were, and I think that we have made great strides in eliminating this, real differences in the positions that were being taken by the Civil Division in defending government agencies, and by the Civil Rights Division in prosecuting state agencies and private employers, and we have really made I think great strides in eliminating those inconsistencies. There are times when I've been very discouraged. My name appears on about 40,000 cases, pleadings, and briefs a year. I, of course, don't see even a fraction of those, but cases that are called to my attention that I do see for one reason or the other, sometimes it's somebody picking up the phone and saying, "My God, let me read you this." And then they say, "Your name is on it." And I just die. And yet the at the same time, I have not been able, and this has surprised me in many respects, to do as much in changing across the board the positions that are inconsistent with my own personal philosophy as I would have thought. And this has been a learning experience. I've developed a new concept, which is winning and losing meetings, and that is that I, when I learn of a case or a case comes to my attention, and I am finding many of the lawyers very responsive in terms of bringing cases to my attention. They think I would be concerned about the position of the government. Then I have a meeting with the lawyers and say, you know, what can we do about this? And I mean, is this really the position for the government to take? And I lose about 50% of those meetings just because there are reasons, both within the context of the adversary system, there are points that should be raised for the government, or we are representing individuals who have been sued in their individual capacity, at which point you really have greater responsibilities to raise defenses for them, there is just more to the position than meets the eye on the other side, and it should be raised. I do think that we can reach a point where the government, as represented by the civil division, takes a view of the cases that is broader than the often parochial views that the agencies take. Government agencies as clients are just as bad as private clients. They first of all, they want to win, and all they're thinking of is their program, protecting their program. And I think as their lawyers, as government lawyers, that we can reach a point where we really do take the approach that the United States wins. Maybe not the agency, but the United States, when justice is done, and we can look at the cases more broadly. And I think this is beginning to happen, though I don't guarantee it in every case, and it has been one of the things that I have spent the most time on, and yet I do feel that some progress is being made. But I don't guarantee it across the board because there are a lot of lawyers out there, and it's very hard in a case. The other aspect of it is that a lawyer who has a case wants to win. There's a tremendous ego involved in that, and I'm not asking them to throw the cases, but it's very hard to take when you're in front of an extremely government-oriented judge, which the vast majority of them are. It is very hard to take a broad view and stand back and say, now what's right here? Should we settle this case? Should we give a little here? But I think we are. I'm certainly interested in reaching that point as a way to approach government litigation, and I do think that we're making progress along those lines. That's all really I wanted to tell you, but I would love to hear what you're interested in and respond to any questions you have about the Justice Department or what. Yeah. Oh, there were many cases filed against the International Women's Year, and we've been doing wonderful work for you. We've won them all. But in fact, we had a team down here. It's been down here all week, getting ready, working out of the U.S. Attorney's Office here, but no cases were filed. We expected some of these people to come in to seek temporary restraining orders here, but they didn't make it in before the clerk's office closed yesterday. So, and I understand that Houston, that they'll never find the judges at home. So it's the U.S. Attorney's Office sent at our behest a letter out to all the judges saying such cases might be filed and that we would be ready to defend them, but no such cases have been filed. So I think we're safe on it. But there was a real spate of cases. There were 11 across the country against the commissions. On the ground that the statute, the statutory requirements were not met in the formation of the delegations. Most of the suits were filed from the right. Yeah, but we got that dissolved. Yeah, they got. Right. But all those suits were successfully resolved. Yeah. Yes. No. No, I feel very strongly just the opposite. I do. I've really learned a lot of lessons early on in this job, and one of the things that I've learned about affirmative action is that you should do it rather than say it. I did. I put out in the document of my goals and plans for the civil division. That I had one line in there which said, given the real problems that we had in terms of our statistics, that I was going to devote the entire summer program to minorities and women. That's all. That's all I said. Just all hell burst loose. I didn't see any problems of reverse discrimination there because it seemed to me that that the summer program where we hire law students is our major recruiting device. And if we had a problem with white males, it would be one thing to hire white males in it. But since we have problems with the numbers of minorities and women, to use your major recruiting device when you have limited resources is perfectly justifiable. But I was told that I would be sued, but I never was. I really don't. And I think that the very phrase reverse discrimination is one of those trigger words. That's really not what we're talking about. And I think the government filed a brief in this case, in the Bakke case, which I think had very good language when it talked about racially sensitive admission policies and those, what makes sense in terms of any kind of a program has to be looked at in the context of what it is that you're admitting people to, and it's different across the board. It might be different in the Justice Department or at advanced jobs than it is in college admissions or special programs in high school or whatever. You have to look at the context of the whole program and then say, if you were to apply a racially sensitive or women sex sensitive criteria, what would be fair in the context of the needs of this program and its history? Did you?
Yes, I did. Is there any people in the government making any contingency plans in case Bakke case decided in a way that perhaps we would favor?
One of the problems with the Bakke case is that if it's decided wrong, and see, I think that there are just tremendous government programs that are going to be disrupted and perhaps dismantled. But nobody's making contingency plans because we can't really even imagine such an eventuality. I think the worst that can happen in Baki, and I may be eating my words shortly, but not before this.
Red Dragon, you got a copy on that?
And there'll be a lot of women and minorities hired at Justice before then. But the it is that the thing will get very fuzzed up, that there will be no bright lines established, that there will be many opinions by differing justices of court. Nobody will be able to figure out anything. And then people of goodwill will go on doing what they've been doing and continuing to get sued. That is true. I mean, I hope this doesn't sound unduly cynical, but I think that's the likely result, and the government will go on with its programs. At least this present government will. But maybe a bright line will be established. But I think that's the worst that can happen. I just really doubt that they're going to come out and say you can't do these programs at all. Yes.